folks. Welcome to the LRIS Premium Podcast Series. My name is Will Aitchison, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Dan Kerrigan. Dan is the Chief of Fire and Emergency Services for Upper Providence Township, which is in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. It's just outside of Philadelphia. He is the co-author with Jim Moss of the best-selling book on firefighter fitness. It's called Firefighter Functional Fitness. You can find it on Amazon, and they also have a web page for the book. Dan is a 33-year veteran of the fire service. He serves as an at-large director for the International Association of Fire Chiefs Safety, Health, and Survival Section Board of Directors. He's a certified peer fitness trainer, an ACE group fitness instructor, and he presents both across the country and internationally on the topic of firefighter health and wellness. As you'll hear from this interview, Dan has simply a wealth of information about not only fitness and the best approach to firefighter fitness, but also about firefighter health, the rates of incidence of cancer and heart disease, and some very particular topics that are not often discussed as much as they should. The impact on health of sleep deprivation, which is a necessary component of the fire service, and what you can do about that, how you handle things like dehydration and necessary rest and recovery at a fire scene. Dan has thought this through, and he's thought this through quite extensively. I think you're going to find this to be a very informative interview. And while Dan is a fire chief, the lessons that he's talking about here apply across the public safety world. They apply just as much to, for example, police officers as they do to firefighters. So with that, I give you Dan Kerrigan. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
I'll tell you, Dan, the last few years have seen an emphasis on fitness for all public safety employees, but perhaps for firefighters more than others, that we've never seen in our careers before. What do you attribute that to? What's going on out there?
In terms of the awareness, you mean?
Yeah, the awareness, the focus on it, the notion that there's an employer, a role
sure.
in this, an employer responsibility almost. And then we're also seeing, for example, the national study being done right now, the epidemiological study on firefighters and certain types of diseases. It's like we have a very strong focus on a topic that really a dozen years ago people weren't thinking about very much.
Yeah, I honestly think it has everything to do with a bunch of us from various walks of life within the fire service really driving the push for better health and wellness. So, I mean, based on a lot of anecdotal information that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that although the act of, you know, the job of firefighting is dangerous and there are things that can happen to you that could cause you to get hurt or killed at a fire, that the primary driver, the primary thing that's been killing us over the last several decades has been our own poor health. And so organizations like the IAFC, the IAFF, you know, within the IAFC, the Safety, Health, and Survival Section, which I'm a part of, we've taken it upon ourselves to just push the issue as hard as we can push it in the name of trying to reduce on-duty deaths in the fire service that are attributed to poor health. And you know, as we like to say, the tide is rising. So we think that with every year that goes by, every month that goes by, we think we're getting more people's attention. Certainly the focus on cancer and exposure is part of that process, as well as the heart disease and the other factors that we talk about. But I think the other thing, too, is that as the fire service evolves and new blood, if you will, comes into the fire service, what we're trying to do really is a legacy statement, right? We're trying to get the young firefighters to buy into this right from the start so that 5, 10, 15 years from now, when those firefighters are in leadership positions, this is going to become the norm, not the exception, that we pay better attention to our health. And as fire chiefs, that we prioritize our own people's health as much as we prioritize other things like, you know, like equipment and apparatus and stuff like that.
Let's get some of the numbers out of the way, Dan. I'm struck by the fact that 45% of line of duty deaths by firefighters are from heart disease, and that the average age for a heart attack in a firefighter is 49, and for all of the rest of us, it's 66, and that doesn't even take into account non-fatal cardiovascular events that are occurring. What are the things that a firefighter can do to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease? That's the big killer of firefighters. What can they do?
Yeah. I mean, those numbers are they're sometimes difficult to capture in black and white, if you will, like the approximate age of a first heart attack for a firefighter can be anywhere from 49 to 52, we'll say, because the data sets that you pull that information from can vary, you know, but ultimately we can say that, yeah, on average around probably 45 to 50% of the on-duty deaths are attributed to heart disease. What can we do? It's got to be a comprehensive approach. There's a lot of things that need to be discussed. Overall, it really needs to be a lifestyle of moderation if you choose to become a firefighter or an EMS provider or a law enforcement provider. Our belief is that you're buying into a certain lifestyle and that you're held to a little bit of a higher standard. And part of your job is to take care of yourself, because that's the expectation that the community you serve has for you, as well as your family and your coworkers. So it always starts with the mind and the mindset and accountability on a personal level, that you're going to take care of yourself because of what you chose to do. Nobody was drafted into the fire service. You made that decision yourself. So we need to take better care of ourselves. The actual components are widely varying. We all know that physical training is an important part of what we do, but we can't ignore proper nutrition. We can't ignore proper hydration. We have to pay attention to exposure reduction methods so that we're minimizing our exposure to carcinogens. We have to look at sleep and rest and recovery as a big component of firefighter health and wellness, or I should say emergency responder health and wellness overall. So there's a lot of different components. Behavioral health is also another one that we really must pay better attention to. And in terms of actual physical components, I think it all probably really starts with a comprehensive medical examination on an annual basis that's designed for firefighters for what we do. So we need to develop that baseline. We need to be checked on an annual basis for lots of different things that are going to affect firefighters differently than the typical civilian population. And we need to do that on an annual basis. Provides us with the early detection for things that we need to know about with our hearts, with our exposures and things like that as well. So it's a comprehensive approach. There's no one thing that you can do to improve yourself. You really need to be all in, if you will, on your own health and wellness.
And we are going to be talking, have been talking, and will be talking in this podcast almost exclusively about firefighters, but that's a little bit wrong. Let's say you have a structure fire somewhere. You will have firefighters who are attempting to control that fire. And hopefully now, in this day and age, all of them are wearing SCBAs and turnouts and everything like that. And then a block or two away, you're going to have police officers who are probably not wearing SCBAs or turnouts. So a lot of the things we're talking about with respect to firefighters, almost all of them, wouldn't you say they apply to law enforcement officers as well?
Oh, I absolutely feel that it applies to it. That's why I try to, you know, although I'm a firefighter, I've been in the fire service for quite a number of years. When I think about it and when I talk about it, I try to talk about it in terms of emergency responders, right? You know, police officers have a whole host of different hazards that they face, but as do EMS providers, but there's so much overlap as well. And those folks can be exposed to the same things that we're exposed to. And certainly from a physical standpoint, can be asking their bodies to perform at near or above maximal levels in certain situations as well. So I really like to look at it as emergency responders. Even though I'm in the fire service, I'm looking at all of those folks in the same, through the same glasses, if you will, through the same lenses, and saying we all need to take better care of ourselves.
Dan, I want to talk about, before we get into particular fitness measures, I want to talk about some of the topics and conditions you mentioned at the start. First of all, let's discuss cancer. Can you tell us what's going on at the national level right now in terms of studying cancer in firefighters?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of great researchers out there that are doing everything they can to determine what the real true effects of our jobs are, if you will, on our tendency or instance to contract different types of cancers. And I think what we're trying to do is educate the fire service, if you will, that although we are in a hazardous occupation and we are accepting certain risks as a result of that, there are a lot of things that we can do to minimize those exposures. So a lot of it is behavioral, mindset, procedural, those kind of things that don't even really cost a lot of money to implement. So it's as much a culture shift or a culture change, if you will, as it is anything else. So the things that we learn from the researchers, we try to implement in practical terms in the fire service. And it could be something as simple as you mentioned earlier. Today, we know that we need to wear our masks all the time when we're in a hazardous atmosphere, not just when we're actively fighting fire, but during overhaul and anytime we can be exposed to smoke and the products of combustion. So we know that. We do a better job of that now. The fire service in particular is known to have a lower rate of smoking than the general population. So we know that we look at things like that, and we know that smoking causes cancer, and we try not to do that. There are simple things that we do on the fire ground, like they call gross decontamination, which is essentially just hosing each other off after a fire and knocking all the bulk debris and everything that's on our gear off of ourselves. We know that now from research that can eliminate up to 85% of the carcinogens alone just by a soap and water gross decontamination on a fire scene. So there's a lot of things that we're trying to take out of the research. And you know, our job is to take all that technical jargon and translate it into something practical that firefighters can relate to, can understand, and fire chiefs can help them implement on a daily basis. Exhaust removal from fire stations. You know, we know that diesel exhaust carries with it a whole host of carcinogens. We want that stuff directly removed from the firehouses. So those are things that, you know, another example of maybe a more expensive thing that we're working on. But we're trying to just educate folks that there are a lot of things that we can do on our own from a behavioral or a procedural standpoint that can drastically reduce our level of exposure and contamination when it comes to the jobs that we do.
You also mentioned dehydration, and I don't think people talk about that as much as they should. That's a very significant problem, isn't it?
It is on a number of levels. So I'll step back and say, just in general, our entire conversation here, that people need to understand that everything is connected in terms of health and wellness for firefighters. So as I said at the outset, no one particular component in and of itself is going to make you a healthier firefighter as much as if you look at all these components and integrate them all into your lifestyle. So when it comes to dehydration, there are studies out there that show up to 91% of firefighters show up for work at on duty in the morning already dehydrated at some level or at some extent, and that's documented. So,
Dan, how does that happen, Dan?
Well, hydration is as much a behavioral issue as it is a physical issue, right? It's how much do we drink and what we drink, and training ourselves to make sure that we are regularly drinking water as much as possible to maintain proper hydration before we go to work, so that when we do have to exert ourselves and we know we're going to lose fluids, that we're better prepared to withstand that beating that our body's going to take. So drinking more water and drinking less diuretic or caffeine-based fluids is a huge way to combat that. It's just a matter of training people, if you will, to that it has to happen throughout a given day, not just when you're thirsty. So waking up in the morning and the first thing you do is drink a big glass of water is a great way to sort of make a positive improvement to your lifestyle. Reduce or eliminate drinking soda and caffeinated soft drinks and things like that, and replace that with water. Those kinds of simple things help us to proactively hydrate so that when we do go out there and have to go to work, we're better prepared to withstand it, the effects of it.
You have mentioned something I'd actually never thought about before, and that is the impact of PPE on dehydration. Makes sense, mm-hmm. but hadn't thought about it. How do you deal with that?
Well, you deal with it honestly by properly hydrating proactively and adhering to rehabilitation procedures that should be already in effect at your own department. So once you've gone into a fire and you've exerted yourself, when it's time for a break, when you use up the air in your cylinder or what have you, that you go to the rehab area, that you immediately doff your gear, you take all that stuff off, you allow that heat to escape, you rehydrate, you get your vitals checked, and you're monitored for a period of time and to make sure that your body is starting to recover appropriately based on the vital signs that are taken. So if you think about it, you know, our turnout gear is designed to keep the heat and everything away from us, right? It's sort of I don't want to say it's encapsulating, but it definitely is a barrier between the environment that we're going into and our bodies. And as a result of that, all of that heat gets trapped inside between the gear and us, right? So between the increase in thermal temperature and the dehydration and the exertion, it all adds up together to a very difficult thing for our hearts and our cardiovascular systems to handle. So Denise Smith from Skidmore University did a tremendous study on the effect of heat stress and dehydration in firefighters. It's actually called that. You can actually just Google the effect of heat stress and dehydration on firefighters and download the entire PDF of the report. And there's a lot of details in there about the effects in terms, you know, scientifically speaking, that basically play out to say that we need to hydrate proactively. We need to exercise regularly to increase our capacity to do the work. And we also need to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves once we've done the work to make sure that we're recovering properly.
And for our listeners, we'll post a link to that study on our webpage associated with this podcast. Dan, when you're talking about exertion at a fire scene, I just saw a study. Boy, I want to say it was only 2 or 3 weeks ago, pretty recently. It wasn't on the fire service. It was in law enforcement. And what they did was to basically monitor the pulse and the blood pressure of law enforcement officers as they're driving around on patrol. And then what happens when a call comes in, and what happens when an emergency call comes in, and then what happens when they get out to the scene, and then what happens if they have to take some sort of physical action at the scene. And I was struck by the fact that the pulse rate of police officers jumps significantly with each one of those events. And once you get up to actually trying to corral a suspect or something like that, you're up to 200 beats per minute. Same thing happens in the fire service, doesn't it?
It certainly does. You're pushing your body beyond theoretical maximums, if you will. So when you think about an individual that's driving their heart rate up around 200 beats a minute or more, that's, I like to call it superhuman. It's very difficult, for example, to recreate that kind of stress in a controlled situation, say in a gym or in a workout, right? So there's a lot of other factors that play into it, adrenaline and the effort that you're putting out to do the work. But if you think about it, that's a superhuman thing that we're asking our bodies to do. It starts when the call comes in, it carries throughout the call, and what a lot of people don't realize is that it continues at a higher than normal rate for sometimes several hours after the incident is over with, before your body truly starts to come down, if you will, and completely recover. So along with that, it's cardiac output, it's the physiological changes that occur in your body systems when you are working that hard. Things like, and not to get too technical, but things like blood viscosity changes, so your blood will thicken as you produce more effort like that. And so all these things work against us. So when you need your body to be at peak efficiency, it's actually, things are happening inside your body to reduce that efficiency. Even the gear that we wear, the respirators that we wear, all of those things serve to reduce our capacity by some percentage, depending on what you're talking about, whether it's an SCBA mask or the gear you wear or whatever. So all of those things work against us, which goes to the importance of being functionally, physically fit to be able to withstand, or better withstand, those rigors, if you will.
One other topic that you mentioned, Dan, was sleep. And we know the numbers out there that 40% of firefighters suffer from some form of sleep disorder, perhaps sleep apnea or whatever it might be. What can be done about that, given the nature of the job?
So unfortunately, because of the types of shifts that firefighters tend to work and the nature of the job itself, is very, very difficult, if not impossible, to maintain a proper sleep schedule. And I think we all understand that. Now, I don't profess to be a sleep disorder expert, nor do I profess to know everything there is to know about how different types of schedules affect a person's body in terms of when they're awake and when they're asleep. I know there's studies out there that are looking at that. But what we try to teach people, aside from all that, is that recognizing that you work a crazy shift, maybe you work a 24-hour shift or whatever, it becomes that much more important that when you are not working, that you do everything you can to maintain getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep, uninterrupted restful sleep a night, the best you can. And part of that means removing the distractions that typically might be part of our lives, like the cell phones, the smartphones, the computers, the TVs, emergency responders out there that like to have, the scanners on and the radios and the distractions like that. Anything that you can do to remove distractions from your routine in the evening when you go to sleep, probably like at least an hour before, to bring you down. Another thing that helps you sleep more restfully, believe it or not, I say this jokingly, half jokingly, is regular exercise, right? So when you go to the gym and when you work out, when you train like that, your body is going to, want that rest, and you're going to sleep more restfully. You can sleep in a nice, cool, dark room. That's another thing that you can do to help your sleep patterns better. And of course, if you still have trouble sleeping, you might need to have a sleep study done. I mean, there's a lot of firefighters and just people in general out there that probably could use a sleep study to determine if they need to be on if they have sleep apnea or something like that. But it's really important for firefighters and emergency responders in general. I'm going to keep going back to this and say that what you chose to do becomes a lifestyle. And even when you're not working, even when you're not on duty, you are still a firefighter, and you need to take care of your body as much or as better, if not more so, than when you're actually working, because it's a lifestyle. It's not just a go to work, sit behind a desk, and go home. Office workers and other folks like that do less strenuous jobs have a much greater ability, in my opinion, to tolerate things like mild dehydration and things like that, right? As a firefighter, if I'm already dehydrated before I get to work, and then I have to go to a house fire and work and do strenuous duties like that, then I'm already behind the eight ball even more. Think about what's happening to your blood pressure as well. So we focus a lot on blood pressure as well, and, you know, making sure you're paying attention to that, because if you're already somebody with high blood pressure, then you're already that much further behind the eight ball when it comes to going and actually doing the work.
Now, Dan, the last of these physical issues that I wanted to talk about before we delve into wellness and fitness is obesity. I've got to say, I was shocked to learn that 45% of firefighters fall under the heading of obese. I mean, Dan, I've seen the calendars. It doesn't look like 45% to me. What's up with that?
Well, there's easily over a million firefighters in our country, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the vast majority of the firefighters that are out there don't look like the calendars that you see, right? All kidding aside, when you look at firefighter overweight and obesity statistics, the National Volunteer Fire Council has some interesting numbers that will show you that within the fire service, our numbers are pretty much the same as the general population. So you might say, well, that's pretty average then. But when you then think about what we do for a living and what's expected of us, that's when the eyes should open and the eyebrows should raise, right? Firefighters should not be at the same level of overweight and obesity, statistically speaking, as the general population. I think you would agree with that. We should be much lower than that. So there's an issue there as well, and that goes to, again, I'm going to keep saying it, it goes back to lifestyle. What you're putting in your mouth, what you're doing in the kitchen is as much important as how much time you're spending in the gym.
Let's talk now about the Fire Service Joint Labor Management Wellness Fitness Initiative, the most recent version of it. It's been around a while. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of that initiative and how it has played out over time?
Well, yeah, it's an amazingly proactive and nonpartisan, if you will, initiative when it comes to labor and management that seeks to demonstrate all the positives that can be had from implementing wellness and health programs in the fire service, right? So it goes beyond actually just how much better shape you're in as a firefighter, and it goes to the level of how much money it can be, the return on investment, if you will. So when you have organizations like the IAFF and the IFC, and they get together and they say, we want to do a study and we're going to pick X number of fire departments that are going to adhere to the different components of a wellness initiative, and then we're going to compare them to fire departments that do not. And it's really just numbers at that point. It's proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that the implementation of proper health and wellness programs in the fire service realize anywhere from a $1 to $5 positive return on investment, oftentimes in the first year of implementation. So
is that a net value?
Yeah, exactly. For every dollar spent, you're getting a dollar saved or $2 saved in some other aspect. So, spending X dollars on annual medical evaluations, they can show you that the result of that might have an impact, a positive impact on a reduction in lost time or overtime costs due to replacement of staff for injuries and illnesses and things like that. So it's a really good document, a lot of good ideas. I think just from a philosophical standpoint, the idea that we need to take as much care or better care of our people as we do our apparatus is probably a good takeaway from that. So there are departments, and I believe in that study, I'm pretty sure there's a department that was used as an example that spends, I want to say, 90%. I hope I'm right with this because I'm drawing from memory, but there are departments out there that spend 90% on repair and maintenance budgets, like preventive maintenance budgets for their apparatus, and 10% on their people, right? And we need to flip that, right? We know the importance of taking care of our equipment and how much money it can save us in the long run, and we've done that for years. We just don't seem to have the same priority for our own people, and I think that's changing. But it's documents like that are proving, especially to the legislators, to the town administrators, to the city council members, when they want to see dollars and cents, it's documents like that are showing them that an upfront investment in your personnel is going to result in a lot of savings in other areas.
And we will post a link to that, the latest report on the initiative, on our website as well. A couple of things about the initiative that I'd like your thoughts about. First of all, the initiative posits that both unions and the fire chief have to take a leading role in wellness programs. Do you agree that that is important?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm speaking as a fire chief. I can tell you that the folks in my department know where I stand on firefighter wellness. And I've been in union environments and non-union environments. I've been on the labor side and on the management side. And what I would say to you, and I know this is easier said than done, I get it, but that relationship between labor and management is supposed to be a positive, collaborative relationship, not an adversarial relationship. So if we're going to do better for our firefighters, folks need to come to the table and be positive about the intent of taking better care of our firefighters and removing some of the preconceived ideas about the punitive nature of things like medical evaluations and exercise and things like that. We need to strip away the excuses in favor of the positive benefits of doing this. And you can't do that unless you sit down at the table across from each other and air out your concerns and describe what your concerns are and what your fears are, and then discuss ways to actually get around those and move forward and put things on paper and document things and say this is where we need to go. So it has to be a positive relationship, and a collaborative relationship, not something that's looked at as punitive or adversarial.
I want to turn now, Dan, to the book that you've written with Jim Moss, Firefighter Functional Fitness. And again, we'll have a link to that as well. In the book, you and Jim have posed a seven-part comprehensive approach to fitness that takes into account some of the factors, many of the same sort of factors, as the wellness and fitness initiative that we've talked about. And let's dissect these for a moment. The first one you just alluded to, annual medical evaluations. You've mentioned why you've thought they are important. How important is it that you get the right doctor selected to do those evaluations?
Well, it's critically important. It's unfortunate and expected even that a typical family physician or practice physician is not going to understand what we do to our bodies when we go out and work. And so for that fact, what we're exposed to, what we're punishing our body systems, how we're punishing our body systems, it's almost unbelievable, to be honest with you, in some doctor's eyes, that those kinds of things can be occurring in your body when you're working as a firefighter. So the first thing we need to do is make sure that our physicians understand the things that we need to look at. When we go to a doctor, we need to say, I need you to look at these things, these components in NFPA 1582, because I'm a firefighter. I'm not an accountant. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a firefighter, and this is what's happening to my body. There's documentation out there about how to do that. It's free. IFC SHS section has a provider's guide to health and wellness for firefighters and physicians that you can literally print out and take to your doctor if your department doesn't offer those medical evaluations. Hand it to them, and it basically describes to them the things that need to be checked from a medical standpoint. So we're going to cover all those different components that are important to all of us, but specifically to firefighters, and take a deeper look at some of those things from an examination standpoint if we're doing it correctly. So, yes, that's critically important.
And it strikes me, hearkening back on something we've already discussed, I would bet the average primary care physician out there in the country who you might go to for a physical examination would have no clue, looking at a firefighter, that they are looking at someone whose heart beats 200 times a minute as a regular feature of their job. And I think that would be just one of many examples.
No, they won't. Most of them won't. And that's not a knock on them, right? I mean, that's not their area of expertise. Okay. So it's up to us to educate these physicians and guide them on what needs to be looked at. And it's also up to us to make sure that our employers understand that it's not okay to just send everybody to the local urgent care down the street to get a physical, right? Without first educating them on all the different things that need to be looked at. I mean, I can tell you anecdotally that I've been to pre-employment physicals as a fire chief or as a firefighter where, you know, I had to debate with the practitioner the need for me to get a chest x-ray. And they will tell you, well, that's not indicated. I don't understand. Do you have a history of any lung issues or anything like that? And I would literally have to almost demand that they do a chest x-ray, you know, for example, right? So those kinds of things are real and they're out there, and we need to make sure we're doing a better job with that. If for no other reason, and I shouldn't say that way, but one of the primary reasons we want to do this is to establish a baseline for each firefighter that demonstrates that when the firefighter comes on the job, that they're healthy, that they're cancer-free, that they don't experience any of the things that are heightened concerns for us as we go through our careers. It's going to benefit them in the long run, unfortunately, if they are diagnosed with cancer or something like that, and they have to fight the presumption battle in their state or whatever. So we need to make sure that these things are documented from square one, from day one, and make sure that they're being done properly to take care of our folks.
And I can anticipate that some of the people listening to us right now are going to have privacy concerns about annual medical evaluations. They will wonder whether or not what is said to the doctor or what the doctor uncovers is then transmitted to the employer that will then put the firefighter's job at risk. How do you best deal with those sorts of concerns?
Well, the doctor should be transmitting a simple message that the individual is fit for duty or not fit for duty, and then go from there, right? One of the ways to also handle a situation like that is to consider having almost a civilian or third-party records custodian that maintains those kind of confidential documents in place of, if you will, the township financial director or the city manager or whoever, right? So if there are concerns about privacy, that number one, your private medical information isn't being blasted out to the department for everybody to understand. Number two is that if something is identified, it's something that we can now help you get fixed so that you can get back to normal duty. It's not punitive. It's something that we've identified because of this, what I like to call a tangible benefit, right? Providing a comprehensive medical evaluation for firefighters is a benefit to them that provides early detection and usually, as a result, early correction of things that they might not even know that existed in their own bodies. So we're not out to get rid of people. We're out to make sure that they're healthy to do the work. And if they're not currently healthy to do the work, then depending on what the situation is, if that means they have to go on administrative duty or some kind of other alternative duty until the situation gets corrected and they get examined and cleared, then that's what we have to do. But the ultimate goal is to basically save their life, not to fire them.
Okay, that's number one, annual medical exams. Number two of the seven, functional physical fitness. What are you talking about here?
We're talking about the idea or the concept that you should train physically for the job that you're going to do. So we're all what we like to call ourselves functional or occupational or industrial athletes, right? We're tactical athletes. So if you think about it in relation to like a sports figure, like football players, they train specifically for the jobs that they do. They do certain things. They train a certain way to become higher performing football players. And firefighters should look at their training no differently. It's performance-based physical training that we're looking for, and it's comprehensive. So as I mentioned earlier before we started the podcast, the concept of the Big Eight of functional fitness, which we introduced in our book, serves to try to simplify that for firefighters that say to us, I know I need to do better, I know I need to exercise, but I just don't know what to do. So here we give you 8 different components that are very easy to remember and that you should focus on when you're physically training. That starts out with core strength. Then we talk about cardiovascular capacity, and we talk about flexibility. So those are the 3 sort of foundational components. The other 5 are functional strength training components, and we relate them specifically to what firefighters do when they go to work. So push, pull, lift, carry, and drag. We couldn't simplify it any more for firefighters than that. If it's something that involves pushing, pulling, lifting, carrying, or dragging, or a combination thereof, and you're doing it safely and effectively, then you're probably on the right path in terms of your physical training.
The third element that you've listed, we've talked about a bit already, which is proper hydration. I was struck by a study that you cited that really there's not a complete solution to this, that even if you are aggressively hydrating during a training exercise, you're still going to lose some portion of your body weight. Is that right?
Well, certainly you're going to, I mean, by virtue of sweating, yeah. I mean, a firefighter under strenuous conditions can lose 1 liter or 2 liters of sweat in an hour. And so nothing we do from the physical standpoint is going to help us to avoid that, if you will. I mean, we have to wear the gear that we wear right now. That's what the best practices are. We know that we're going to exert ourselves. So again, are we going to completely counteract that? No. But can we minimize the effect of that? Yes, we can if we are proactively hydrating from the moment we get up in the morning until roughly about 2 hours before we go to bed at night, right? An hour or two before we go to bed, we certainly want to stop heavy intake of fluids so that we're not disrupting our sleep because we have to get up and go to the bathroom because we hydrated too much. So there's a balance there. But yes, we're never going to alleviate 100% of that, but we can certainly do a lot of good by hydrating proactively throughout the day.
The fourth recommendation you have in your 7-part recommendation on fitness is one I've been looking forward to talking to you about, and it's the whole notion of sensible nutrition and bringing sensible nutrition into the firehouse. I want to hear how you're going to get kale into the firehouse.
Have you ever had kale chips? They're excellent.
I actually have. I'm from Portland, Oregon. You don't need to ask if I'd had kale.
Here's the thing about nutrition, and I'm going to preface this by saying I'm not a registered dietitian. I'm not a nutritionist. Our approach, as is written in our book, is we believe pretty simple. We don't talk about specific diets or anything like that. Our approach is very simple. It's 3 words. Food is fuel. So your job is to put the right foods in your body from the right sources in the right amounts. So it's as much about educating yourself as it is anything else. In no way am I speaking about never being allowed to have a slice of pizza or a couple potato chips, or you're forbidden from drinking a beer or anything like that. This is about moderation, a lifestyle of moderation. So if we generally put the right things in our body from the right sources in the right amounts, because quantities are important too, then we're doing the right thing. We're not asking people to become rigid and deny themselves the basic pleasures in life, but we do need to make sure that we're focusing, generally speaking, on those three things.
And how does that work within the personality dynamics in a firehouse? Any conflicts come up as to menu?
I mean, you would certainly think that across the firehouses in the United States, there are several conflicts. I mean, you're going to have, no matter what you're talking about, what component of wellness you're talking about, you're going to have those that buy in, you're going to have fence sitters, and you're going to have those that ultimately will never come over to your side. And that's just life. That's reality. But one way we can control that is, especially in firehouses where you have kitchens and you have guys that like to cook, girls that like to cook, so the firefighters like to cook and prepare their meals, is if you're cooking, then you are somewhat controlling what the firefighters are eating. So that's one way that we tend to push out when we do our workshops and conferences, is to suggest that the more that you control what you're putting on the table, the better off everybody else is going to be, whether they like it or not, right? So that's one way to approach it. I mean, ultimately, it comes down to things as simple as what you see and what you don't see. Out of sight, out of mind is a huge component of proper nutrition. So if you're displaying or putting out, if you will, the healthy snacks, the nutritional stuff, and hiding the cookies and the potato chips in the pantries, you're more likely to do that. You're more likely to go and snack on that kind of stuff, for example. So quantities is another big thing. We all know firefighters like to eat, right? But in America, we know that people pretty much always finish everything on their plate. So if you give people smaller plates and control portion sizes a little bit better, if you want to have some potato chips, you don't eat them from the bag. You take them out and put them in a bowl and put the bag away. If you do little things like that, then you're doing little things to treat yourself, but also control the amount of that kind of stuff that you're ingesting. The bottom line is your body needs carbs, your body needs protein, your body needs fat, and your body needs fiber. You need all of those things to function properly. It's just what sources you're getting them from and how much of them you're eating is important.
The fifth factor you've listed, rest and recovery. We've talked a little bit about the sleep end of it, but one thing we haven't talked about is the importance of rest and recovery both during an active operation and immediately after an active operation. What can a fire department do with, you know, very frequently limited resources to provide for rest and recovery during an actual fire operation?
Sure. So when we talk of rest and recovery, we look at active and passive rest, right? We look at it in both ways. We've talked about sleep, and we understand the importance of that, and we all like to sleep. We just don't get enough of it. So we want to do better at that. But active and passive rest is important, too. That can come in many forms. It can mean something as simple as rest days during the week of your weekly workout regimen, right? So you shouldn't be working out 7 days a week. Your rest days are as important as the days that you're in the gym, okay? It could mean something as simple as active recovery after a workout where you are doing things like cool-down stretching, foam rolling to roll out adhesions in your muscles that are tight or sore from a workout. Even things like massage are forms of active recovery that can help us to improve the results of our hard work. And in terms of the firehouse, look, people ask us all the time, well, if I go to the station in the morning and we have a fire and we work hard at the fire, then do I still need to go back to the station and do my workout? And I say, no, you've already worked out, right? A fire is a workout. So we need to provide and understand that if firefighters are out there busting their butts, if you will, at a working incident, that we need to give them a little bit of a rest period as well after that when they come back and allow their bodies to recover a little bit. We don't want to keep punishing them by, for example, going right out to the drill ground and doing the drill because it was just scheduled that day, no matter what. Right? We've got to look at the human side of things, and that's up to the line officers and the chiefs to be monitoring their people. It could be something as simple as if you're on a busy piece of apparatus in a station and you're getting your proverbial butt kicked for 12 hours and you haven't had a chance to sit down, that you switch off and have another crew take over for that unit that's busy, and you move that crew to a less busier unit. There's lots of different ways to approach that. It starts again with the mindset and the realization that we need to take better care of our people first.
What about during an actual operation? Say you've got a structure fire and it's a tough one, mm-hmm. and you're out there for an hour or two or three. How do you get the necessary recovery during the operation?
Well, it's a matter of establishing an appropriate rehabilitation sector and making sure that our personnel are adhering to work and rest periods as per your local procedure. So, and that could change based on the atmospheric conditions, the time of year, the weather, anything like that that might play an extra role in that. But that's as much a supervision, I think, function as it is a cultural function. You know, the old saying back decades ago was, quote unquote, rehab is for sissies. Just like in terms of cancer prevention, you know, back in the day, you know, it was a badge of honor to have dirty, sooty gear and faces and stuff like that. That whole mindset is changing, and we know now that it's more important that your gear is clean and your body is clean as best we can. Same thing goes with rehab on the fire ground. It cannot be ignored, and firefighters must come out of that environment that they've been working hard in. They must go to rehab. They must get their gear off. They must start hydrating again, and they need to get their vitals checked and then be monitored to make sure that their body systems are recovering appropriately. And that's just the way it has to be. So that's as much a supervision or management or standard operating function as it is anything else.
Okay, on to our sixth element, exposure reduction. This is both an equipment issue and a tactics and deployment issue, isn't it?
Sure. Well, yeah, this really speaks to the things that we can do to reduce our level of exposure to carcinogens and the like. So we discussed that at the outset a little bit, some things that we can do on the fire ground to make sure that we're doing things properly to take care of our bodies. We can talk about, you know, once we clear the scene, that we're getting our contaminated gear off of us, that we're not carrying it back to the firehouse in the same passenger compartment that we're riding in, that we're using our wipes to wipe off our affected areas of our skin, that we are properly decontaminating and laundering our turnout gear, that all of our equipment is being decontaminated properly, that we're showering within an hour or so of getting back to the station, getting out of our station uniforms that are full of sweat and exposure to carcinogens and so forth, and changing clothes, and not taking any of that stuff home to our families and laundering it properly at the station in designated areas. Even as much as you can, laying out your station itself with different zones, hot zone, warm zone, cold zone, so that you reduce or eliminate cross-contamination within the station itself. So there's lots of different things that we can do, many of which that cost little or no money to reduce carcinogen exposure.
Last topic, behavioral health resources. Everything here from the various wellness steps that a fire department can take and whether you can build incentives into the system. This is a rich area to be tended to, isn't it? A lot of options.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're paying attention to the statistics in fire and EMS and law enforcement, you'll know that and everybody out there, unless you've been living under a rock, knows that we suffer from a pretty high rate of suicide. And you know, that notion that some people have out there that we as human beings are somehow different than typical civilians that do other jobs and are somehow able to process or withstand the things that we see both acutely and chronically, if you will, over time in our business is silly. I mean, we all need to take better care of each other. And in my mind, part of that is properly educating the firefighters on what you're looking at when it comes to your partners and their behaviors and things like that, and making sure that we understand that it's okay to say something if we're not feeling right about something, and we should be reaching out and know that we can do that without facing a stigma or anything else like that. I would say that a typical, this is no offense to any employee assistance program, but the counselors in typical employee assistance programs, just like the physicians that we talked about earlier, are not necessarily equipped or can even comprehend some of the things that we see or have seen over our careers that could affect us. And so when we talk about behavioral health resources, we need to be talking to people that have been trained and understand how to help us, that understand what we do and what we've seen. So it can't be a boilerplate, check a box procedure or policy that is offered to an employee. We need to pay better attention to the folks that are actually providing the services, the counseling and things like that, so that we're paying better attention to what our own people. So yeah, it's a huge deal, and certainly I think along with everything else that we've already talked about, thankfully that is changing to the positive, I think, out there because of some really good people out there that are pushing that specific issue and trying to get people to understand that it's okay to not be okay, and you can, there's places to go, there's people to call, there's people to talk to that can help you.
Yeah, I have become a true believer in the notion that all public safety agencies need to spend a lot more time focused on the mental health and well-being of their employees, and that there is a much greater role for mental health professionals in the organizations themselves, not the typical psychologist who's going to give you a fit for duty or not fit for duty exam, or the psychologist who screens you before you get the job, but someone who is there to recognize the problems that employees may be having, who can give the employees proper training on how to deal with those problems, and it was sensitive to the very unique needs that you see in a public safety agency. We need more of those sorts of people who are just there to help. They're not there to discipline. They're not there to say you're not fit for duty. They're just there to help.
Exactly. And it's up to all of us, especially the fire chiefs out there, to make sure that we're seeking out that training, that education, those resources, and making sure that that's not something that we're ignoring. And I think it's happening. I do. I'm a glass half full kind of person anyway, just by nature. So coming into something like this back when I did and focusing on firefighter health and wellness, you know, I knew right from the start that, like most of us do, that it's more of a legacy-based thing that we're trying to do, that we're not going to change, you know, decades of certain types of influences on our culture overnight. But we do know that if we keep pushing the issue and keep the education up and keep providing the resources and coming up with new ways of getting those resources locally, that hopefully, like I said earlier, in 10 years or so, this is all going to be more the norm than the exception, that we shouldn't be having to be out there talking about this incessantly and trying to convince people the importance of it as we are now. It's legacy work that we're doing, really, to be quite honest. It's the reality of it.
And keying off your glasses half full, from the union perspective here, I'm sure that someone's going to be out there saying, well, can we get some sort of incentives for participating in this? What sort of incentives are out there that are available that work? Not ones that don't work, but incentives that do work.
Well, I mean, I suppose one could say, you know, in the strictest of terms, that nobody should need to have an incentive to be healthy, or to want to be healthy, or to perform at peak performance levels in our job. But we all know that we're all human too, and that's not really probably the reality of it. So, in our view, you know, some types of incentives that can work really go back to things like health and fitness related incentives. Like if we have a contest at our fire department, I don't know, for example, to lose weight or whatever, then what can we provide the winner of those? You know, it could be gift cards, gym memberships. It could be training sneakers or some sort of implement, you know, like a fitness modality or something like that, that the winners get for their station. Or let's say you have a 10 station department and your station wins a certain contest, for example, maybe you get the new rowing machine in your station or something like that. There's nothing wrong with competition like that, as long as it's positive and the peer pressure is positive. But there's lots of things like that you can do to sort of incentivize folks to do a better job. You could give comp days. You could give what are you limited by? Only your creativity and in some respects your budget, right? And how much importance you as the fire chief are going to place on the health and wellness aspects of your job.
Last question for you, Dan. You're the fire chief there in Upper Providence. How have you put these principles into play in your agency?
Well, I tell you, I've been I started out toward the end of September last year, so I'm still new here. But one of the first things I did, even before I was hired, was tell anybody that talked to me or interviewed me, I really wanted them to understand, if they hired me, what they were getting. And I emphasized the fact that I'm going to be the type of fire chief that's going to place a huge emphasis on the people and their health and their wellness. So they knew that coming in. I met informally with every firefighter that we have here, some of them even before I officially started, and they knew that. They were aware, most of them, of the book we wrote, and that helped too. But since I've been here, I have been able to secure funding to improve our annual medical evaluation. So we're going to be bringing in folks to do our medical evaluations in 2020. That are specifically trained to do, as we talked about, the firefighter evaluations. And we've also implemented the NFERS exposure tracking software and through the International Public Safety Data Institute. So we're now requiring all of our firefighters, after any exposure, to go on, log into their system on their smartphone and track that exposure. And we're taking it to the next step of doing a live link to our emergency reporting software, so that any incident we go to will automatically populate into the system, so that they don't have to manually enter it, and then they just go in and put their information in. So those are a couple of the big things that we started right away. Again, it's only been a few months since I've been here, but definitely implementing them immediately. The other thing I would probably say is the biggest opportunity I have so far is that we happen to be in the beginning stages of constructing a new fire station here. So I'm going to have the opportunity from the ground up to have this station built and designed with all of the known best practices that we have available to us right now in terms of exposure reduction and things like that. So I'm really excited to be able to sort of lead by example in that regard. And hopefully I can, you know, promote that regionally and beyond, and you know, I get that not everybody has that opportunity, but I can tell you that I'm taking full advantage of the opportunity I do have to make sure that our folks are going to be well taken care of. I'm also bringing in probably early this year, I'm going to bring in a stress first aid class and provide that regionally to the entire area. So I'm excited about that. We're going to include police departments, fire departments, even the dispatchers in the county are going to be invited to come and learn a little bit more on the behavioral health side about how to better recognize when things are going wrong with people around them and some of the sort of the indicators and how to take better care of ourselves mentally.
And when you said that, I just realized, and it's one of those shame on me moments. We didn't talk at all about dispatchers, but dispatchers face, not the exposure problems, but they face the stress problems and
absolutely
the heart rate problems. I mean, there's a lot of lessons in what we've talked about for people on the non-sworn side of the equation.
Yeah, I don't, you know, and you're right. I not calling them out by name is probably, for me, a much a function of the fact that I automatically group the dispatchers into those categories in my mind already. So we don't ever want to lose sight of the fact of what they're dealing with on a daily or nightly basis, and that they need to be able to talk to people too, and they need to, you know, you know what's interesting is in a lot of cases is that the dispatchers rarely know the actual outcome of the incidents that they send folks to, right? So if you think about that, whether it's good or bad, we usually have some kind of closure in terms of what we've had to deal with out there. And in a lot of cases, the dispatchers don't even get that. So that has to weigh on their minds even more so than some other folks as well, I would think. So we definitely want to include them. We're excited to keep them as a part of our team and appreciate everything they do. And obviously we couldn't do anything without them anyway. So we always try to focus on them as well when the opportunities present themselves.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for your time. I think that you've provided us with a wealth of information and the links. I encourage people to check out the links on the webpage. This is a topic that I think is long overdue for a healthy nationwide discussion. So, Dan, thanks for being with us on the podcast.
Really, the pleasure is all mine. I really appreciate the opportunity. Anytime that I have the opportunity or any of us in this sort of track have the opportunity to promote responder health and wellness, we'll absolutely take it and run with it. You know, I could probably talk for hours and more about this. I'm sure, you know, you understand that. But I just really appreciate the opportunity. I'm looking forward to the seminar down there in Tennessee. And hopefully we can continue the conversation then.
So, thanks a lot, Dan. Folks, that's been Dan Kerrigan, the fire chief of Upper Providence, Pennsylvania. The seminar he's talking about is LRIS's first wellness and fitness seminar. It will be in Nashville, Tennessee, April 15th through 17th. And with that, thank you for joining us as part of LRIS's premium podcast series. This is Will Aitchison signing off.